Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Zambia Blog Talk Radio. It's Saturday, March the 27th, and we want to welcome you from whichever part of the world that you are listening to us from. And we thank you all for joining us. We are glad. It's another exciting day. I'm sure the weather is good in all parts of the world as we talk right now. My name is Nathan Nkama. I'll be hosting you from the great city of Dallas in the state of Texas. We have an exciting show this morning, evening or afternoon, wherever you're listening us to from. We just want to say we are very grateful that Mr. Elias Chipimo agreed to come back again this weekend, considering the technical challenges that we faced last weekend. And I actually told him, and I graciously thanked him, that it says a lot about him and him agreeing to come back again, and this is exciting. So, ladies and gentlemen, let's brace ourselves and get ready for an exciting discussion. Roger, good morning.
Good morning, Nathan. Good day here in Okotoks, Alberta, Canada.
Yes, sir. It's a great day, and we shall be going to Lusaka very shortly. 718, good morning.
Good morning, Nathan. This is Campbell.
I knew. Campbell is always right on target. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
Are you ready for this?
I've been looking forward to this for a long time. So
I know a lot of people have actually, we had a bombardment of emails saying that he needs to come back, and we are glad that he's agreed to do that, and we are grateful that he is going to join us. Let me welcome a few more other people that are joining us here. 763, good morning.
Good morning.
Is this Dr. Shepande?
No, this is Munyimba.
Oh, Mr. Munyimba. It's been a while. Welcome.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Thank you very much. All right. As we've been saying that we've been looking and we're very excited about this show. Zambia's political landscape has seen a lot of change and events and activities. We started off as a multi-party country after independence, I believe. We switched to a one-party state, and again we experienced another multi-party state in which we are currently, which has been predominantly dominated by the MMD, and we are transitioning now, and we have a new political figure on the Zambia's political scene, and we are very glad that Mr. Elias Chipimo has decided to come back again this weekend, and we are very grateful to him. Only a few weeks ago, he announced the formation of a new party, the National Restoration Party. Mr. Chipimo, welcome to the show, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed for having me on the show again, Nathan.
Yeah, we are very glad that you decided to join us. Let me not waste any more time. People have been anxious in the diaspora to talk to you. And we had a lot of technical problems last week by the our servers who host these things that we do. Let's continue. I know you and I started the conversation, but the rest of the world couldn't hear us. I will repeat the same question I asked you, then we shall pick it up from there. Why form another political party?
Look, it's a fair question, and let me just say hello and offer my greetings to those of you who are on the other side of the world and from wherever you're hearing us. It's a real pleasure to be on the program, and I've been looking forward to this for some time. But to address your question, why form another political party? It's because there is a need for something that will capture the imagination of the Zambian people, particularly the youth and the women, who I think for a long time have been tired and are wondering where the future of our country is going. There's no real alternative that can offer hope. One of the points that I made in my launch address when we launched the National Restoration Party on the 2nd of March, barely 3 weeks ago, was that we've lost the values that drove our nationalists to fight for independence. You know, the spirit of sacrifice, the spirit of service is just not there anymore. And when we looked around, I myself was particularly worried when I saw the political landscape. And like many people, I was completely unsure of who to vote for. But events that have happened over my life for several years, but culminating in the death of my mother in a terrible road accident in October 2008, really opened my eyes to the realization that maybe the ones we are waiting for is actually we ourselves. We've been looking around for leadership, thinking that somehow we can be directed out of the problems that we're facing as a nation by those who are stuck in the old way of doing things. And what we've decided is that, look, we must offer something bold, something new, something really ambitious for the Zambian people and give them a real hope that putting a politician into office is going to make a difference in their life, a meaningful difference in their life.
Interesting. A lot of people have been saying through our blogging and email exchanges that Zambia's political system is one where we have seen a lot of political parties, Mr. Chipimo, come and go. And one of the questions that I was getting is that couldn't you have reformed things within a current existing political party?
Yes, that's another important issue. And in coming up with the idea of the National Restoration Party, we obviously had to look around. But let me ask you, Taito, just look at what's there on the ground at the moment. None of the current mainstream political parties have even agreed genuinely or set a proper course in motion to establish and test their popularity at a convention. Each of these parties has to be forced into making this decision. Now, I ask you, is it possible to join an existing party and to make a meaningful impact on the decision-making process within that political party, within the political landscape that we have at the moment? One example, and I won't mention any names, but I think it will be obvious for anybody who's been following the news. There were two individuals who tried to challenge the lack of a leadership succession process and even questioned the basis on which a pact was being entered into. And what happened to them? Sitting in the hotel, attending their press conference was many people, including television cameras from movie TV. Uh-huh. And the press conference was disrupted. One of the individuals was bundled into the back of a taxi, taken to some location, and questioned. Now, that kind of brutality, when somebody is challenging the lack of a leadership succession process and questioning some of the practices of that particular party, would lead one to conclude that perhaps my views, which are even more radical than the ones which were being expressed by some of those individuals, would probably not be greeted in a dissimilar way. Now, that's not the kind of practice that I would consider conducive to attracting bright, intelligent, ambitious young minds, which really are festering on the sidelines of politics. Let's look at the MND. The NMD right now has decided to, rather belatedly, that, well, they may well go for a convention. But what happened? First of all, you had the chorus of hero worshipping, which took place for several months, until eventually the Western province put its foot down and insisted that if there was to be no convention, then the NMD would lose the West comprehensively. My belief is that they will still lose the Western province comprehensively. But they've had to sheepishly come back and consider exactly how they're going to manipulate the process to ensure that their favorite candidate turns out on top. Now, that's not what I see as a process that can lead to some sensible democracy within these parties that would encourage or inspire a young mind to want to give their talent and ideas to developing the future of this country through one of those political parties. I think that, in a way, it sums up the problem that we have. The democratic credentials and the idea that somehow we can encourage the vibrancy of the younger generation. And when I talk about that generation, I'm not necessarily talking about very young people. I'm talking about the people who would have been too young to play a meaningful role at independence, but they may have been born. And all those who are born after independence. Really, what hope is there for them? And that's why we've decided that we must find some alternative way of offering meaningful hope to the people of Zambia.
Excellent. You are listening to Zambia Block Talk Radio. We are talking to the interim president of the National Restoration Party. Let me go to the phone lines. I know a lot of people want to ask a lot of questions. I'll go to New York, Campbell Lumbila. Go ahead with your question to Mr. Chipimo, please.
Mr. Chipimo, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Sir Campbell.
But first of all, I think this is going to be an awkward question, but could you point to some of the successes of the MMD government over the last 15 to 20 years?
Okay. Some of the successes of the MMD government over the last 15 to 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Let me start, Campbell, by just tracing the origin and the purpose for which the MMD was set up. I know it's something that you know, but I just want to give a context to my answer.
Mm-hmm.
The NMD was a party that, like all new parties when they come through, greeted people with a sense of excitement, but there was also a sense of fear and trepidation. Fear and trepidation because they were breaking a system that had been in existence for 18 years. Kaunda himself had been in power for 27. But it was 18 years that we operated under a one-party state, and that culture that prevailed at the time was very much a part of the Zambian psyche. And so when they formed themselves in 1990, after the amendment to the constitution to allow for the formation of other political parties, very quickly, and it really was a period of only 1 year, they were able to make an amazing impact on the political landscape. It really was a landslide. So the initial cabinet and the team that was put together after that victory in 1991 was extremely broad, deeply intellectual. It encompassed industrialists, it encompassed academicians, it encompassed business people, it encompassed ordinary individuals. And if you look at the first 5 years that the NMD was in office, they did a tremendous amount of work. Now, the context that I want to give you is what Kaunda was able to do with his cabinet in 1964 when they assumed power. Roughly 80% of the infrastructure that we rely on to this day, whether you look at roads, the social services, just the social, political, and economic infrastructure we rely on to this day, was really built or enhanced during the first 8 to 10 years that Kaunda and his initial cabinet were in power. The MND really brought one aspect. They brought in a sense of entrepreneurialism. They helped to break the mold of thinking that somehow you needed to depend on the state in order to achieve something. And if I'm to look at what I would consider the lasting legacy, perhaps, of the introduction of the MND, it would really be that. But unfortunately, all of their ideas were really incremental. There was nothing radical. It was almost as though once they'd won the fight to reintroduce multi-party politics, there was really no other reason why they were existing. And slowly but surely, because of the concern about the lack of loyalty within the civil service, we started to see permanent secretaries with experience and knowledge of the civil service rule book began to be replaced by people who really represented a sense of loyalty to the administration. And that's when things started to become a little bit unstuck, because the civil service, the permanent secretaries, really, they're the glue between the policy that should be implemented by government, that should be formulated by government, and the implementation, which should be really undertaken by the civil service itself. And so it is an awkward and difficult question, because there's nothing other than incremental things that one can point to and say that, well, this is what the MND has done. But I think if I'm to look at a lasting legacy, they did help us to break the mold of thinking that somehow we must be totally dependent on the state and that we're not able to do things for ourselves.
Okay.
You want to follow up with that?
Yes. Maybe I can follow up with another question. I've had a chance to look at your website and look at some of the things that you're proposing and kind of like your model for restoring Zambia. My question is, what is your specific vision and plan for creating jobs in Zambia? Because if there's one thing that I think has been the failure of the MND government is the lack of creating jobs or its specific plan for creating jobs. So what is NAREP's plan and vision for creating jobs in Zambia?
Okay. One of the things that we were saying in our launch address is that our detailed manifesto will be out within 90 days of the day of the launch. We intend to stick to that promise. One of the challenges that we have is whenever we articulate the issues through some media or public fora, there's always a danger that somebody will pluck those ideas out, and before you know it, they're championing them as though they were their own. But nevertheless, let me just give you the broad outline of the philosophy that will underpin this question of job creation, and then also some idea about how we intend to do that. Firstly, we don't see a government as something that should do things for people. I'll explain what I mean by that. There are certain basic things that a government has to be responsible for: education, health, and infrastructure. Those are absolutely critical, and there are certain things which go around each of those three. But that's really where the bulk of the thinking and the resource allocation must go. We want to form a very small cabinet. This is an idea that if the MND want to steal, I'm glad for them to steal it. 12 cabinet ministers, not 23, not 28, not lots of hangers-on around the cabinet table, but 12. And it's clearly outlined, certainly our manifesto will clearly outline what those areas will cover. But the idea is that there are a lot of documents that set out quite a comprehensive plan for each of the ministries as to what should be done. If I give you just one simple example, the Japanese have had a project to modernize Lusaka City. It's been around for a long time. I think there were even some environmental meetings that were taking place, because it's an obligation if you're to do a project of that nature to have a forum where the public can be consulted and give their views. Those need to be dusted off. There has to be an element of political will infused into some of these projects to make sure that they come to completion. Once you embark on that exercise of modernizing a city, you immediately create jobs, because there will be activity which requires the input of people with basic skills to be able to participate in. But the critical area where we want to create jobs, and this is going to be something that will be very different from what we've seen before, is we actually want to start the development from the rural areas. Now, Zambia, in our view, should be a superpower, and it will be under an Arab government. It will be a superpower in alternative energy. Now, I don't know whether or not this has been said too much, but we've been saying that we will model Zambia on Brazil. Brazil has been running the ethanol and flex fuel projects for the last 30 years, very, very successful program. That's the model we'll follow. I've said this from the first day that we came out, and I continue to say it. It may not be surprising that the president is now spending another 10 days in Brazil. He's decided to flying out again. No doubt to try and get some ideas about how to do this. That's fine. We don't mind leading the way in great ideas. But we know that the ability to implement these things is sorely lacking within the MND, so it doesn't worry us that much. But the idea is that once you open up the hinterland and you make the rural areas, what I said in my speech was an oasis of innovation and activity through just introducing some basic policies that create the internal demand, then all of a sudden you have the opportunity for world-class jobs to be created. And it ties in very much with the way in which we will educate our children. Right there in the rural areas, the technology is available today to provide in every single village electricity off-grid. It's available today to provide systems that would enable you to deliver education that's relevant to the industries you will be establishing right within the rural community, so that when somebody leaves school, they're trained for the job that they're going to get right within that community as we develop Zambia as an alternative energy superpower. So that's really where the jobs will come from, and the training and the education will be relevant to meet that demand. Within 10 to 15 years, we're saying that Zambia will be one of the top 10 technology users in the world. And it will be the kind of technology which is relevant, applicable, useful, and can help us to leapfrog certain stages of development. That is there today. It just lacks the political will. It lacks the ability for a government to adopt a posture of sacrifice and service-driven leadership. And that's what we're saying is really missing. And no matter how much you shout this from the mountaintop, if you don't change the administration and bring in this new way of looking at things, you bring in this value-based leadership, we will not achieve those goals.
Excellent. Let me go to Minnesota. Mr. Munyemba, please go ahead with your question.
I don't have a question.
Okay, he dropped off. Sorry about that. We will go to Wisconsin. Mwata, please go ahead with your question for Mr. Chipimo.
Mr. Chipimo, good morning.
Good morning, Mwata.
How are you?
I'm not too bad, thank you.
That's good. It's good.
Let me just say that I was feeling a little bit depressed this morning after we visited Kanyama. I don't know when you would have last been in one of these areas, but the situation is depressing.
Mm. Well, I was there like two months ago, but not when during the floods, but it was about 2 months ago. Anyway, my question for you is the brutality you see in our current Zambia is a perfect outcome of the current design. By this I mean our society. How do you could you describe the factors that are governing the current situation? In this, I'm referring to the question that was asked to you a little earlier, that why wouldn't you just join an existing party? My question is, could you describe the current design and how would you re-engineer it? Let me expand on that one for a second. When you walk around Kanyama, you're going to find people of divergent views. Some of them are going to agree with you, and some of them are not going to agree with you, and some of them are not even going to understand what you are saying. So how are you going to re-engineer Zambia so that Zambia could succeed?
Okay. That's a good, broad question. There is brutality in society, and it's at many levels. But if you were to ask me to define what the society is characterized by today, I would say four things. You know, our society in Zambia is characterized by mediocrity, corruption, greed, and neglect. Those are the things that are pivotal to our interactions as a society. Mediocrity, corruption, greed, and neglect. And unfortunately, the way that the political system is structured, it's very much a winner-take-all scenario. But it's the kind of thing that, because so many people are turned off by politics, only a few, are able to make the final decision as to who it is that assumes power. And the power is so heavily concentrated in the hands of the presidency and a few individuals around the presidency that it serves the interests of those that want to hold on to power to maintain the status quo exactly the way it is, to keep the brutality, to keep people turned off from politics, so that at the end of the day, you only have to convince relatively few people by of incumbency and encouraging those who share your cynicism. And what do I mean by sharing your cynicism? It means that there are those who believe that there's no real alternative. We only have a choice which really leads to the same thing. So therefore, we will just make the most of the opportunity that comes to us at election time when the handouts come. And that will be how we will recover something from this process. But what happens in between, we just go back to our normal lives. Now, what are the normal lives, and where does this brutality come into the daily lives of these individuals? It's amazing how it is that the situation is just about the same. It doesn't matter which compound you go to, which rural area you go to. Roads, sanitation. I mean, you look at the road in Kanyama, even when it's not flooded, absolutely appalling. How do you get an ambulance out into some of those areas? It's not going to happen. How do those people survive? They don't. What happens is if you don't have a wheelbarrow in some of those areas, then that's it. You die because you'll be too fragile for somebody to carry you to the clinic, and it's going to take too long, and it's too awkward a process, and they'll probably cause you even further discomfort. So people have to survive by begging from somebody who would be able to be in a position to help them, just with something as simple as a wheelbarrow. That's how people carry their sick from one place to another. Now, when they even get to the clinic, what do they do at the clinic? You have to get there, like in Matero, you have to get there by 5 hours. And I'm sure the situation is the same right across all of the high-density communities in the country. You have to get there by 5 hours. And in order to be attended to quickly, you have to carry between 5 and 15 pin to pay the clinical officer to put your name as the first on the list. And even when the doctor does get to see you, they may not be the right drugs to treat you. Now, that to me is brutality. And it's not as though the leadership is not aware of it. I think they've just stopped to realize that they should even care about it because it doesn't affect them. I give an example of a policy that we would introduce, and it's something that I wish the MND would also imitate. This is another policy I wouldn't mind the MND imitating. Tell yourselves, like Kagame did in Rwanda, no more flying abroad for treatment for ministers at government expense. If they want to do it, let it be at their own cost. Because my estimate, and it's really just a personal estimate, is that we may be spending between $100,000 to $200,000 a month flying people abroad for treatment and attending to all of their medical needs, critical and non-critical, including, by the way, their dental requirements. Now, the government has very, very clear policies about how to improve the primary, the secondary, at the district level, and the tertiary health system. Very, very good plan. You speak to some of those civil servants working within the Ministry of Health, exceptional. But nobody's ready to dust those plans off, put in place the political will and the resources to ensure that they are properly implemented so that people don't have to face this kind of brutality. Now, the other type of brutality is the stone-throwing type of brutality, where you simply use the youth who really are looking for something decent to do. Wherever you drive around, you see them, they'll say, boss, just give us work. We're ready to work, but there just isn't anything for us to do. They pick on those poor individuals and use them instead to throw stones and to carry on the legacy of insults, which tends to be characterizing politics today. So what will we do that's different? I think that was the other part of your question, Marcus. Well, this is the reason why we're saying, first of all, restoration. Okay, because we have to restore the value that drove us to fight for independence. Those are now gone completely in our politics today. Somebody has to put them back at the center of the political activity. Then secondly, what we're saying is that, you know, if we don't make values the basis of everything that we do, and we're saying that we are relying on 8 core values, excellence, integrity, responsibility, service, equity, humility, commitment, and a sense of community, we're saying that, look, we've defined each of those. They will be, and you'll have seen them on the website, they will be how you must judge us. We're not saying that we're saints, but we're saying that while we're in governance, we must be ready to be complete. People will insult us, they will shout at us, they will do all. It's because they are angry, and one must never, never turn that kind of criticism off, no matter how brutal it is. Because until you start to listen, and until you have a sense of service and a sense of community where you say, I will act in the greater good, until you have a sense of transparency, so that even if you feel that it's important for you to fly around the world, you know, 15, 20 times in one given year, nobody's saying that you as a leader don't have the right to do that. Do it, but publish it. Tell us exactly how much it's costing us every day to have you out of the country. And then let us compare with the cost of the drainage, putting in the roads, making sure that people don't have to use wheelbarrows in order to get to a clinic just to die in the waiting room.
Thank you, Mwata. Mr. Chipimo, one of the things that one observes on the Zambian political scenario is that you would be considered as belonging to the elite in the Zambian society. How will you, does your party and your team intend to reach out to the grassroots? That's just a very polite term. You know, the Zambian terminology, I don't want to go there. Those are the people that vote and do the politics in Zambia. How does your party intend to reach out to those people down there?
We are already doing it, Titus. I mean, it's interesting because generally I think one looks at my background and maybe looks at the background of the few of the individuals who are part and parcel of the team that we are creating. And, you know, they feel, and quite genuinely, it's not something that one should try and run away from or hide. I'm not going to pretend that I haven't been fortunate in the way I was raised, the kind of environment I've had to live in. When we went through to Kanyama today, one of the members of our team was saying, you know, we look at these situations that we confront here, and we see the people that are having to live through them. Really, the conditions are appalling, really, really appalling. I mean, even worse than whatever it is that you can imagine, it's a lot worse. And the one thing that binds the concerns we have with the concerns they have is that there's a belief that maybe if somebody who can identify their problem, now, that's not the same thing as saying that you have to identify with me. You see, because you have to have somebody who is able to offer solutions to be able to provide leadership. Now, that's really what they want. They just want to hear. And this is the first thing that they always ask us. How do we know that you are going to keep your promises? And so when we go and meet them, we identify that there are people who are, believe me, so frustrated. They just don't believe that there will be any change. So you find, which party do you belong to? I belong to this party. Okay, why are you voting? They said, I just want change. I'm just tired. Then you say, what kind of change will it bring? You see how they start to reflect upon it. And then when you talk to them about what it is that you want to do, the plan, the vision, you know, all of a sudden they say, this is what we need. This is exactly what we need. And so we're saying to them that we are not going to keep our promises when we come into office. We're going to start to keep our promises now. We're not going to wait until we get into power in order to keep those promises. We will start to focus on those needs now so that whatever it is that we say we will do, working with the community, we will start to work with them immediately. The moment that you start to work with people, believe me, they don't care where you come from. They're just concerned that you've identified that they have a need that needs to be addressed and you're ready to roll up your sleeves and address that need them immediately. That's how we're connecting with the grassroots. We're not trying to pretend that we are the grassroots. We're not trying to hide behind how we were brought up, but we're saying we now want to give up something. I mean, I've given up my paid job. My wife now has to work full time. Otherwise, we will not have the means to continue to live the way in which we've done. We've had to scale down tremendously. And so, for me, it's demonstrating that type of sacrificial leadership. And there'll be others that have made even greater sacrifices. In fact, the people in those communities are making sacrifices every day. But what we're saying is that, look, we can work with you to find the solutions. We can give the vision, and we can actually roll up our sleeves and come and be a part of what it is you need to do to change things for the better. And that's how we're connecting with them.
Excellent. Let me go to Okotox Canada. Roger Charlie, please go ahead with your question.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chipimo. This is Roger Chari from Okotox, Alberta, Canada. You have used some very interesting adverbs here, intelligent, ambitious, young people. Now, we seem to be making the same mistakes the older people are making. And those mistakes says the best way you can do whatever we have to do is to form a political party in Lusaka, and just to come from Lusaka. That is the formula which has failed everyone. The Satas have failed. Everyone has failed with that formula. Why don't we come up with a different formula for the young people, which says this time we are beginning with the local governments. We are going to rule from the bottom up and not from up and down. Your comment, please.
Yeah, very, very good point, Mr. Roger Chagi. And it's not a point that we have ignored at all. And I think maybe the way in which we tend to project ourselves, because some of us are based in Lusaka, can give the impression that we haven't tried to identify these mistakes of the past that other political parties have tended to get themselves caught up in. But in looking at all of the political parties, we did try and analyze this issue very carefully. Our whole approach is actually to build the party and the structures of the party from the bottom up. And if you, I don't know when you will next be in Lusaka or in Zambia, but what we would like to do is to demonstrate to you the process that we have started. When we launched the party, we actually had 200 members, 20 from each of the provinces, and then the additional numbers were made up from those who were part of the secretariat right here in Lusaka. It is a major issue. In fact, when somebody was discussing the question of this new party with me, long before it was launched, they were saying, you see, this country is very big. It's very complicated. Its people are very fickle, and they're very cynical. There was a fifth thing he said, which I won't remember. But it really made us reflect very carefully on how we were, what was going to be our penetration strategy. Now, without going into too much detail about how we are doing it, one of the things that we've been incredibly impressed about is how the people, particularly in some very far outlying rural areas, they're very, very clear about what has gone wrong. What they're saying is that before we can give them our message, the first thing that we hear them say is, you know, we've heard all these things before. We know exactly what's going to happen. This politician who hasn't been here since the last election will now come, and this is what he will start doing. And whether it doesn't matter which place you go to, that's what they're all saying. And again, they ask us the question, okay, so how do we know? This sounds very good, but how do we know that it's going to be different this time? And again, it's about engagement and work immediately. So that if you say that, well, we will come and we will work with you on a particular day to do this, once you've identified all their problems and you do it, it goes a long way to then realizing that this is more than just a party that's been formed in Lusaka. And we have people waiting, wondering, when are you going to come and set up the structure? But we are challenged, Mr. Chadi. We're challenged by resources. Contrary to what people may be saying, you know, this is not a party that's sponsored by, you know, anybody other than the individual members who have a heart for this country, who love it and want to see something different. They want to offer real hope. And that's why we're appealing to you in the diaspora. You can make that difference. Not just in giving resources, but in giving you ideas. You have relatives and friends dotted all across the landscape of the country. And they're people that you know who are effective and efficient at being able to identify and respond to the community needs using the limited resources that they have. We have a lot of ideas about how to interact in that way. But we believe that once that message gets out, and remember, we've only been in existence for 3 weeks, but you know, for us, by the time we hit month six, there will not be a corner of this country that one of our members has not touched and been able to make a meaningful impact in, so that those people can see that in government, this is the kind of administration that will make a meaningful difference in their lives.
Let me go to New York. Cletus Ntimpa, question for Mr. Chipimo.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chipimo. My name is Cletus Ntimpa, and I have one question for you, and it's about the Zambian economy. You know, what do you think is the biggest problem with the Zambian economy? And please don't say that we don't have resources, because we do.
Wow, what's the biggest problem? one of the things that I've learned in my limited time on Earth is that sometimes it's convenient to put things down to one particular issue. Whereas the causes of challenges and problems are usually multiple, and they're usually interconnected, and something that doesn't look as though it's the biggest issue can very often end up being the biggest issue. And the way I would describe the biggest issue is to say, well, what is it that if you were to start to address, you would see the positive change that is required in order to overcome the symptoms of the problems that we see? Now, we have a problem when you look at the economy generally of its structure, because the economy is really a function of the activities collective that generate production and output. Okay, it's really a function of those collectives. Now, there's generally an interference by government, and there is not enough being done in a certain direction by government in order to stimulate economic activity and economic growth. When you sum up all those things, what I would say is the biggest problem, and when I say the biggest problem, I don't mean the biggest cause, but the thing which, if you don't address, you will never get around the economic challenges we face, and that is leadership. It begins with leadership, and it ends with leadership. You can look at our terms of trade and say that, well, look at Zambia. We don't dictate the income that we earn as a nation because our biggest export commodity is determined by factors beyond our control. And we are a huge import-dependent economy, and the factors that determine the price of those imports, again, are beyond our control. Kaunda tried with CPEC in the 70s, teaming up with different countries that were copper producing in order to determine the price. It was very easy for the West to shoot that idea down because they simply bought stockpiles and were able to flood the market to keep a control on the price. So really, the things that we cannot do as a nation to balance our terms of trade in a way that would be favorable without a lot of very careful thinking and planning. Now, you could also say that Africa, its population doubles every, I think it's 20 years, whereas in the rest of the world it doubles every 40 years. Now, that puts mega constraints on resources, especially where infrastructure is already very poor and in many areas non-existent. And with the increasing cost all the time, the cost of delivering services therefore just becomes more and more, and these problems combine to become very overwhelming. You could go on listing them. Now, the real challenge is, what is the leadership doing about it? So if you have to ask me, what is the biggest problem facing our economy in Zambia today, I will tell you that it's a lack of leadership to get us out of those problems. It's a lack of awareness that the government can actually stimulate economic activity. Look at what Lee Kuan Yew did in Singapore. For a country that had pretty similar, if not worse, economic statistics than Zambia, to be where it is today, a country that could lend the Citigroup, its sovereign wealth fund could lend Citigroup $11 billion to bail it out of its problems during the financial crisis. That, to me, is a question of leadership. There will always be problems, but if we focus on what the problem is rather than how is it that we resolve it, then we'll always be in a comfortable situation where we can blame others and justify why it is that nothing positive will happen during our watch. And for us, we cannot allow that to go on.
Excellent. You are listening to Zambia Block Talk Radio. We're talking to Mr. Elias Chipimole, interim president for the National Restoration Party in Lusaka. Let me go to Minnesota, Dr. Shepande Chizumba.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chipimole.
Good afternoon, Dr. Shepande.
Okay, thank you. One of the main challenges that your party is likely to face, I think, will be the fight against hunger and poverty. And one reason I think we face this problem is over-dependence on rainfed agriculture, And as an agriculturist by profession, I would like to find out from you, first of all, what is NRP's policy on irrigated agriculture? And secondly, I would also want to find out your views on the red card versus the white ribbon campaign in Zambia. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Chizuma. Yeah, interesting questions. You are the kind of people that we need to be speaking on these issues, not necessarily on behalf of NAREP, although we greatly appreciate that, but just to be articulating what you believe, you know, the way forward is on these issues. Prior to our manifesto coming up, I can really only give you my personal appraisal and perspective on these issues, and that gives a steer as to how we as a party will go. Irrigated agriculture, and you're right. I mean, you know, if one can deal with feeding oneself as a nation, then you've gone a long way to dealing with issues of hunger and poverty. But if you look at what it is that put Zimbabwe, and that we're just going to one neighboring state, what put Zimbabwe in the place that it was at the height of its agricultural prowess? it was that they developed a bank, an agricultural bank, if you like, that focused on developing the kind of infrastructure that would enable agriculture to be developed on a major scale. And I think at one time they would probably have been the second largest producer of tobacco, and I'm not extolling the virtues of tobacco speaking to an audience in North America. You know, obviously, you know, there are ethical issues around that, but I'm just giving you one example of how it is that intervention to build the kind of infrastructure that would enable mass irrigation or irrigation on a major scale to allow agricultural production to flourish and develop is something that we need to be doing as well. Now, if you look at areas that are prone to drought or areas that you know, lack sufficient water to be able to carry out major irrigation schemes, definitely there is a way in which you can put in place the infrastructure. You dam existing water courses in a systematic and structured way to enable the people of the southern province, for example, to be able to feed their cattle and to grow maize and other crops. And then you've also got to, I think, look beyond just the question of irrigated agriculture. There are aquatic areas, and I'm sure you'll be more aware of this than I am, areas in the western province, but they're dotted really across pretty much the whole country, where you can grow wheat and barley on the basis of the water that is retained on or near the surface in order to generate a sensible crop without having to put in place very expensive infrastructure. So you've effectively got natural areas which are aquatic, which can generate harvests and productivity that will complement the idea of promoting irrigated agriculture. But we can't ignore it. We've got to take a leaf from the Zimbabwe experience and put in place the infrastructure by putting in place effectively the funding to enable these long-term projects to come to fruition. Now, you also mentioned this issue of the red card, white card. We were quoted recently in the Times of Zambia, and I know that it was something that, you know, was very deliberate because the Times of Zambia made headline news that NAREP decided that it's not going to participate in the red card campaign. And that was really a question that, it wasn't in an interview, it was a question that came up when the young head of global justice in Zambia decided that he was resigning and joining NAREP to become a part of the full-time team. And for us, the issues actually are very, very simple. What does the red card campaign represent? This is, you know, politics is not a game of football. And I think one has to be very clear about that. People are genuinely angry. They're genuinely upset. And, you know, when you've closed off avenues for them to be able to express their anger and frustration, they will find means which may in some ways threaten issues of public security. But that is a reflection of just how angry and frustrated they are. And unfortunately, the reaction is always the wrong reaction. Threatening to clamp people down. You know, these are the signs of a nervous state. And one should never curtail the freedom of expression of individuals. I may not agree with what you say, but I should defend to the death your right to say it. And what I would say about the red campaign and the yellow campaign and the white ribbon campaign, these are all offshoots of the campaign that took place during the third term debate in, I think it was 1996, when there was plans underfoot, orchestrated by the leadership of the MMD, which included one of the members of the opposition party, to see a return to power of President Frederick Chiluba after his second term. Now, it had a spontaneity and a momentum that grew from the grassroots. It wasn't something that was directed, you know, by an individual. And what do we mean when we say a red card? We're saying we want you to quit office now. We've gone to a lot of trouble to have a presidential by-election. I don't want to be part of another process of having another presidential by-election. And what are we doing? We are creating a monster for the future. Because the very people who are then saying that, no, you're offside and must leave office immediately, you know, if you find that they come into power, they will face exactly the same thing. You would have unleashed a monster, which will be very difficult. You don't want to get that genie out of that bottle. And there, if people really want to issue a red card, they can issue it at the time of the election. That's my personal view.
Excellent. It's amazing, this issue of the red card and the white ribbon that has been brought up by Dr. Shepande. And you know, Mr. Chipimo, for me, what has really amazed and impressed me at the same time is how the Catholics have stood by, is it Bishop Mpundu? And even the Vatican says they are standing with him. I mean, I don't understand how politicians can be so insensitive to the democratic rights of the nationals. Anyway, let me not get into that. We have somebody joining us from Lusaka. I know you are going to recognize this one, Mr. Chipimo, a colleague and a friend, Jacqueline Muna Musitwa. Jackie, welcome to the show. Hello, Jackie. Okay, it looks like we lost her. We have a lot of people joining us, Suzio, Henry. Thanks, guys, for coming on. Area code 469 and everybody. Let me go to Mona. Are you there? Okay.
In fact, I was speaking to Mona recently. I don't know if she's now back in the U.S., but
no, she's in Zambia.
She's still in Zambia. Okay.
Yeah, she's still in Zambia. She was. Let's see. Area code 248.
Okay,
248, could you please tell us your name?
Yes, my name is Suzio. I think I received a phone call from somebody just to remind me that Mr. Elijah Chipimo will be on today. So,
yes.
All right, you know, hey, this is an opportunity that I cannot thank you guys well enough. But my first comment, and then I'll ask a question, or maybe I should just say two questions that I have. One to do with agriculture. What has Zambia done about, if anything at all, with regards to avocado export? Because I know when I was growing up in Zambia, we grow these huge avocados. And it just kind of hit me. I'm like, starting out as a young guy, I worked in restaurants, and there was such a huge market for avocado, and I would see these tiny little things in restaurants out here, and people that have, you know, had a look at avocado that you see out here, get these little avocados, and Zambia has such a huge quality. Western markets, including places like South Africa, that would be something that could, within the agriculture, that could, you know, help improve exports. But my question is to Mr. Elisha Pimo is, what methods are you going to employ to make sure you educate, you know, the voting masses in Zambia? And I'm talking specifically because I like what you're saying, and for young people like myself that left Zambia when I was about 17, and I've never looked back, but I've always had that passion in me and that love to have a government that has a room for a guy like me, that still pays passionate just as everybody else, that my views shouldn't be dismissed just simply because I'm young or I don't know any better. And I think if guys such as yourself, if parties like you can have room for every type of voter, for everybody that really has the passion, because we do not feel that the government appreciates us. And the first and last time when I called into the radio station, excuse me, I talked to the late President Mwanawasa's wife, and I asked this simple question. I was given an answer, but I wasn't somewhat impressed. There's nothing a government in terms of besides providing essentials and the room and the atmosphere in which people can flourish. Besides that, government does not manufacture goods. So my question to her was, what are you going to do to attract the diaspora community? You know, I'm here. I'm in the military here. I'm a political science student. At some point in my junior or senior year, I want to minor in economics. But my question was, what are you doing to attract people such as, you know, the diaspora community to make sure they come back home? Because a lot of these people have something to bring back that can benefit regular, you know, Zambians and Zambia as a whole, and the government included. So what are you doing to attract them? Her answer was basically that the Zambian government has no jobs that we would be interested in. So therefore, you know, they haven't really reached out. And I'm like, you know, it reminds me and puts me back to this saying that it's not what the government, one of the American presidents that said, it's not what the government can do for you, but what you can do for the government. And I always believe that the people, you know, if they, the conditions are right, the people are the ones that are responsible to uplift a community, a village, mm-hmm. country. Mm-hmm. So what are you going to educate these people? I mean, so that we're aware that you guys exist and we need to be passionate and follow you.
Which state are you calling from, Susio?
I'm calling from Michigan.
Michigan, all right.
Right outside Detroit.
All right. Go ahead, Mr. Chipimo, respond to that. Susio serves in the Marine Corps, the U.S. Marine Corps.
Okay, Susio, first, I really like your spirit, and I like your focus and your concern. And it's really going to be people like you that will build the foundation of the dream that we have. And it's a dream that you share, because all the things that you talk about are things that, you know, concern us, and they concern us very deeply. And they're part of what drove us to do what we're doing now, because we didn't see anything that could meet the needs that you are talking about now. None of the parties seem to have the structures that could promote the diversity of thinking, a diversity of ideas, a diversity of suggestions, and just a diversity of solutions, and what it is that we should all be doing. Because, you know, nobody has a monopoly of wisdom. Nobody. It doesn't matter how clever they are. Even the cleverest person in the world, there's always another way, and there's always a better way that things can be done. And even if somebody has the very best way, there's sometimes a different way or a different time within which to take that particular approach. So when you start with this story about avocados, I'm very touched, and I was smiling because I'm actually writing a book at the moment, which is almost complete, and I hope to publish it in April. And I tell a story in there about avocados, because I grew up on a farm. And we had lots and lots of avocado trees, and we had a little market store where we used to sell our goods and our chickens in city center market. I don't know if you would have known it at that time, maybe not, but it was just a ramshackle of, you know, tin and wood at the time. But I used to man that stand on three mornings every week, and there was somebody who came looking for avocados, because at that time you couldn't find avocados in Europe in any of the stores. I think it was something like 1980, 1981. And so, you know, I tell the story in the book about how it is that this guy comes across these avocados, and he's really looking for some good avocados. But I knew that year the crop that we produced was not that great. And so I took him around to another store, and I told him that he should actually buy those other ones instead. And he was so touched by that sense of concern that he was getting the right product, that even though he bought some from the other guy, he came back to our stand and bought everything that we had. And it taught me a very valuable lesson about honesty, and how it is that I think if you strive, you know, to just be true and to be honest, and it's something that's very hard for all of us to do. But when we do it, it's amazing how God responds. You know, he's able to do infinitely more than we can ask or even imagine. But how do we tie this back to, you know, what we're going to do to educate young voting masses? Well, it's exactly those kinds of stories. It's the kind of passion that we need to demonstrate that will ignite the youth. You see, the youth has energy. They've got drive. You know, their ideas aren't always right, but you cannot take away that spirit. And right now, if I was to give you the numbers, you know, just a set of numbers, 39, 48, I think it's 53, and then 74. Now, 39 was the age that Kaunda assumed power when he won independence. He was the youngest leader of the Commonwealth. I think 58 was President Chiluba's age when he came into power. 48 was Chiluba. And then 53, I think, was President Mwanawasa. And then we now have somebody who's over 70. Now, if you look at the structures that need to be put right, and the energy that's required to generate the kind of development that would make a meaningful impact on people's lives in our country, right across the whole 752,000 square kilometers of it. This is not going to be done by somebody who doesn't have energy, drive, a bold and ambitious vision, and a real passion and commitment, and the ability to be able to articulate the issues in a way that makes people feel convicted in their hearts that they too must play a role. And that really only comes with, you know, the kind of energy that a generation, a new generation brings. And so for us, one way, you know, that we educate, you know, the young is to say, well, look, let's first of all lead by example. Okay? If we're talking about people making sacrifices, let's make the sacrifice ourselves. If we really want people to be inspired by us, let's be humble. The moment that you come out arrogant and, you know, all that stuff, even the youth get turned off by it. But if they can see that, you know, here people who, you know, may have accomplished something, but they've decided that they're going to now play this role, you know, that encourages the youth, and that makes them feel like, okay, we can now listen to your message. But you've got to get into their lives. You've got to say, okay, what is it that you are going through? And really try and understand. But it's the only way to really ignite the passion of the youth. I mean, we are on Facebook. Somebody commented on Facebook the other day on a side issue that, well, you know, this is why we're using Facebook. Facebook is just for kids. And we're like, well, out of touch are you?
How absolutely.
How can you possibly be? You know? So, you know, the questions that, you know, you were asking the former first lady, you know, what are you doing for the diaspora? Well, you know, the diaspora, you play such a major role. I mean, people were saying to me now, why is it that you travel to South Africa to speak to Zambians abroad when the fight is really at home? Well, the fight is with every Zambian. You're not there because you're running away from something that, you know, you don't want to face. You're there because you want to advance yourself, and you feel it in your heart. It's why you called in. You feel deeply in your heart that you want to make a difference for your country. You just haven't quite found a way that you can be inspired to doing that in a way that will make you feel that your contribution will make a difference. That's what we want to offer to people like you and so many others. And we want to do it in a way that will keep us open to promoting excellence. You know, when we say excellence, we're saying we must set standards and we must seek continuously to improve so that even when we go wrong, we can say, okay, why did it go wrong? How can we do it better? Not sitting around and figuring what's the biggest insult that I can throw out so that this guy feels bad. No, that's not leadership. We've got to be driven by a desire to make a difference, a meaningful difference to the lives of everybody, including those who are at the worst end of the spectrum of society.
Excellent. Ladies and gentlemen, let me just point out here, like we said at the beginning, that Mr. Chipimo's National Restoration Party is only 3 weeks old. The purpose of this discussion is just to interact, get the heartbeat and the direction which they are going. And all of you will agree that we cannot exhaust everything on this forum. And what we are just trying to do is probably just lay that communication line with him and the diaspora, because this is one of the platforms at which we do that. What I'm going to do is we cannot keep him forever, and I appreciate him taking the time to be. I'll allow two more questions, and then we are going to wind up. Let me allow area code 469. 469, please tell us your name and where you're calling from.
All right, this is Chilekwa Mumbanda in Dallas, Texas.
Chilekwa, you have a question for Mr. Chipimo?
Absolutely, yes. How are you doing today, Mr. Chipimo?
I'm doing great, Chilekwa. Thanks for calling in.
No problem. All right, well, my question takes a different direction because I have a question regarding the intra-operation of your party in Arab. Now, one of Africa's contributors to a stunted and crippled democracy, if you will, lies in the unwillingness of our political parties to practice democracy within themselves, and this eventually spills over to the entire nation. You know, like they say, charity does indeed begin at home. Now, in Arab's case, what steps are you taking to ensure that the party institutionalizes democracy to avoid Narep being a personal to hold a party of one Elias Chipimo, as clearly is the case with Sata's PF and President Banda's MMD? That's my first question. Okay. Can I get in the second question?
Let's just do one question. We are running out of time, and we have a lot of people also waiting to ask. Thanks, Chilekwa. Mr. Chipimo, would you like to respond to that?
Chilekwa, thank you. Yeah, this is an issue that really exercised our minds so much that the way we designed the constitution and some of the planning that we had around the interim arrangements for NAREP and getting ourselves off the ground really have helped us to shape something that we feel could go a long way to addressing the issue that you raised. Now, let me be very, very honest with you. This is not an easy process. And when I say it's not an easy process, what I'm trying to say is that it doesn't matter what situation you put yourself in, how cleverly you draft your constitution. At the end of the day, laws and constitutions are implemented by people. And the really critical thing is, what values do those people bring in? Do they come in with democratic values, with a democratic outlook? So while we've done, I think, a fantastic job in crafting a constitution that will make sure that it's grassroots-driven, issue-driven, and not personality-driven, and you'll be able to see a copy of that because it's got structures that don't tie to the usual, ward chairman, section chairman, branch chairman, et cetera, where it's like a false democracy. But we are engaging people within the party structures that will actually be responsible for identifying the development needs, and it's based on the work you do, not the title you hold. So that's the first thing. But as I was saying when I started, the really critical thing is, what values do you bring to the process? And for us, those 8 values that I outlined, they will be the thing that guide us. If you look at our website, you will see the value, the NAREP value star. Everywhere we go, we talk about values. During the course of these questions and this interview, if you replay it, you'll see that I've mentioned values over and over and over again. It's because I know that, power has a certain pull. And, no matter how it is that we think we may feel right now, when you're confronted with that moment, when you have the power to be able to do something that might benefit you personally, even though it's not for the greater good, you're going to have to be a very, very strong person to avoid the pull of the power leading you to doing something wrong. So we're saying, look, hold us accountable to values. And these are the values we're going to keep reminding you all the time. And that's how we will show willingness to continue to practice democracy. And that's how we are trying to institutionalize democracy within our party.
Excellent. We have our European friends now coming live. All right, let's go to the UK. Please introduce yourself and tell us where you're calling from and ask your question to Mr. Chipima. 6325, last number. Patson, is that you?
That could be me, Nathan. Thank you.
Please introduce yourself to Mr. Chipima and ask the question.
Sorry, I didn't catch that, Nathan.
Go ahead with your question. Tell Mr. Chipima your name and where you're calling from.
Thank you very much, Nathan. Mr. Chipima, my name is Patson, and I'm calling from the United Kingdom.
Yes, thank you, Patson, for calling in.
Just wanted to find out how I'm not sure. I thought you were coming in at 14 hours, so I've missed a bit of your talk, your speech. But I just want to find out what difference, what principal differences are you hoping to make from all the other 67 parties in terms of providing for the people of Zambia, the youth, the women, the children, and the unemployed.
Okay, youth, women, children, and the unemployed. Okay, it's a very broad, wide-ranging question, which does touch upon a lot of the issues that will come out in our manifesto, which we referred to in our launch address as something that we'll produce within 90 days from the 2nd of March. We intend to stick to that promise. But let me start by saying what makes us different, firstly, from the other parties. Because a government or an administration, should I say, because I think there is a distinction between an administration and a government. It's a civil service and then those who decide that they're formulating the policy and the direction of the nation. And we're saying that, look, there are 4 things that really make us different, which will impact on the lives of the youth, the women, the children, and the unemployed. And firstly is that we have what we consider to be a very bold and ambitious vision. And, you know, the details of that, you know, other than making Zambia, you know, the superpower in Africa of alternative energy, which will generate the use of appropriate and applicable technology and will also unlock the hinterland and really make the rural landscape an oasis of innovation and activity. You know, that draws in the youth, that draws in the women, that helps on the back of the kind of education we can deliver using certain types of technology, which, you know, people, you know, in your part of the world will be much more familiar with, and also the unemployed. It addresses those issues. But what else? The second thing is the values. You know, without value-based change, you may as well just change the furniture. But you see, the structures that, you know, uphold mediocrity, that uphold corruption, greed, and neglect, those are still firmly intact. This is not an exercise in replacement. It's an exercise in true change. It's an exercise in transformation. And we need a transformed leadership that can lead by example. And it's only using the value-based approach that we believe that can be attained. What's the third thing? It will bring a sense of vitality to this process. You know, this has to be energized. This is not like one of those countries, you know, like the one that you're in at the moment, where even if you have a 70-plus-year-old, because the systems are so well established, you know, the structures are in place that help to monitor and make sure that, you know, resources are properly allocated and that there is a proper oversight function. You know, those systems being in place there means that, you know, some of these societies can get away without having a vibrant and leadership that can represent a sense of vitality. For Africa, that certainly for Zambia, that is an absolute necessity. The development challenges across the wide spectrum of our country are just so great. Without that vitality, we're not going to see the kind of results that will make a difference to people's lives. And then the last thing is a sense of personal responsibility. We have to challenge each and every one of ourselves. You know, if there's corruption in the top leadership, well, it's because it emerged from a society in which corruption is tolerated at the very basic level. And we have to start to say to ourselves, for us to understand what change we need in our leadership, we need to first of all make the change ourselves.
All right, let's go to Minnesota, Mr. Titus Matala.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon, Mr. Chipimo. Quick two questions. I wanted to find out, everybody in politics in Zambia seems to kind of exploit the cadres. What are you offering different from what the PACT is offering and MMD? As you know, everybody is trying to capitalize on the cadres who are the same poor youth and the same people that don't have jobs and looking for handouts. Secondly, quick one, what would you do with China for today? They're building stadiums. I don't think we need stadiums. The football team is not that great. Again, how do you transition that to the poor people in these fields of agriculture and all these other areas? I wonder what we do with that 1 billion we get from China.
Thank you, Titus.
Yeah, I can tell. Thank you very much, Titus. Good to hear from you. How do we use the MMD? How do we use the PF? How do we use the UPND, the whoever cadres, you know? Because these cadres all, at one point or other, will identify themselves. Now, there's one interesting thing that happened on Youth Day, which took place 2 weeks ago. We were part of the team that marched on Youth Day in solidarity with the youth. And on one side, we had the MMD cadres, and then on another side, there were PF cadres. Separated, you know, some short distance, but, you know, you should have seen the size of the rocks that these guys were carrying and threatening each other with running little near skirmishes. And then they would rush. When they were running past, they would look at us and say, "You guys are okay. It's just these guys who are a problem." You know, and it was very interesting that already there's a sense of identification that, you see, how you project yourself as a leadership and the philosophy that you apply through your structures in your organization will really reflect in the discipline or lack of discipline that's there in those who follow you. And unfortunately, the youth and the cadres of today have really been exploited for the wrong reasons. You know, the concern has never been about whether or not they have the right skill set to be able to meet the challenges of life ahead, but really whether or not they can be rented in order to carry out certain activities to achieve certain intimidatory outcomes when confronted in this battle of politics. That's not how we want to use the youth. We want to really empower them. We want to give them a sense of honesty, and we want to demonstrate to them that we can respond to what they call the IGAs, income-generating activities within their communities. It's engaging with them to say, okay, you know, you have your little panel-beating operation along this road, or you want to be able to, you know, make desks, or you want to be able to sell talk time. You know, the discussions that can engage them and help them to dream about an even better future than they may imagine for themselves, and to work with them to achieve, you know, those dreams. And there are many ways that these things can be done. You know, there's an ability to leverage resources and support. There's so many people that are ready to help, but they just don't know how to. And there's so many people on the other end who are ready to receive this kind of support. Like as mentioned earlier, we drove past some youth today in Kanyama, and as we stopped, some of them were saying, look, sir, please, we just want something to do. We want some work. We don't just want to be sitting here idle. So that's the kind of engagement that one has to start. And it's amazing how willing they are. But because they have nothing else to do and somebody's ready to exploit, you know, the few that are ready to go down that road, unfortunately, this tends to be the way the youth are characterized. But they're not all like that. In respect of China, look, China or any other country, it comes back to the one issue that I have identified, and I think that many identify as being the problem in our country and countries across the continent. It's the issue of leadership. You see, the Chinese will not come in and dictate terms to you unless you allow them to. So how do you deal with whether it's the Chinese, whether it's the Americans, whether it's the English? Everybody's in for their own vested interests. Not everybody is altruistic. But I'll say that there's one thing that we have to do as a nation, and it's one thing we will prioritize, and you'll see it in our manifesto. Let us define our national interest. If I was to ask you, what's Zambia's national interest? You know, there's no real debate that's gone on around it. Nobody really knows. And we're going on, you know, claiming to be leaders, and yet we have never actually defined our national interest. You know, the Americans, you know, they will tell you, you know, you understand some basic things which are definitely in their national interest. And they articulate them well. And so you see the philosophy that underpins Congress's actions and activities will reflect that national interest. We need to do that as a nation. Once you've done that, it's very easy then to see how it is that you're going to engage with China, because China will tell you there's the very good and there's the very, very poor in terms of what it is that you want. If you want someone to build you a road very quick with very little tar and whatever it is, well, they can find you a company which does that. But if you want one which will build you a state-of-the-art road which can stand any weather and will have the best technology and practices applied to it, well, they'll also do that. There are just some things that we must look to other nations and say, what is it that that nation is good at, and how can we leverage the capabilities of that nation in a way that fits in with our national interest when we know what we want for ourselves? And that's a debate that we would have, not just with China, but with every single nation. And the problem has been that we tended to blame China when the problem has really been the lack of leadership on our part.
Mr. Chipimo, as we conclude our discussion here, so one of the things that have really dogged most of these political parties and governments is the constitution-making process. Waste of resources, manipulative, or what's your comment on that very quickly?
Okay, very quickly. For me, I would have done this constitutional-making process very differently. Unfortunately, when you look at each of the Constitution Review Commissions, the majority of them have tended to be reactive. And when you look at the number of submissions that have come through collectively around the country with all the Constitutional Review Commissions, they're probably less than 10,000. Now, 10,000 as a percentage of the population is very, very, very small. It's true that people have been worried that it's about balancing power. But when you rush things through and when you have vested interests trying to push an agenda in a particular direction, then what you find is that there can sometimes be a manipulation of the constitution-making process, and we're not building a process that will yield a constitution that will stand the test of time. And that is my concern. How I would have done it is very differently, but maybe that's a subject for another day. But certainly it would involve much more engaging with schools, communities, theater, everything, role plays, to help people to understand what these constitution provisions mean. Then you can get a better response from them to decide the way forward.
Is your party going to participate in the 2011 presidential and parliamentary elections?
My answer to that question is that not only do we intend to participate, we intend to win. in the 2011 parliamentary and presidential elections. This is a drive that must give people real hope and a real alternative. The time is not too short. In fact, for us, the time is just right. The energy and vitality we have to take us there is very much intact, but it needs the help of the people who are listening to this program, people in the diaspora who believe that, you know, it's about change, it's about us, and quite frankly, it's about time.
Please give us your website address, Facebook name, and any other information that people can contact you on, and your final word to the diaspora community.
Well, firstly, Nathan, I really want to thank you for this opportunity. I genuinely believe that, you know, whatever it is that we can imagine for our country is very possible, but it requires us to work together. It requires us to stand up as one man, one woman, one Zambian, and say to ourselves that even though it seems impossible, as Nelson Mandela once said, it always seems impossible until it's done. And this is something that is very much within our reach. It's a generational challenge. The reason why we have leaders who are over 70 leading a nation that requires the vibrancy and vigor of a new generation today is because you and I as a generation have failed. And we must take up this mantle of responsibility to leave a mark on our nation's history. National Restoration Party was formed precisely to address that need. We want to introduce value-based politics into our country and revive the spirit that drove our nationalist leaders to fight for their independence. You can reach us on www.newzambia.org, and there's a link there to Facebook. We will soon be getting onto Twitter, and we'll be soon starting a blog and have an online interaction at some stage. We have a secretariat that's based out in Woodlands on 43 Nariquanda Road, and the numbers to reach us on are +260 260 336 or 260-340. You can also email me directly at echipimo@newzambia.org. Thank you very much for this opportunity to address you.
Mr. Chipimo, we are very thankful. We shall be getting back to you in 6, 8, 9 months when the manifesto is ready, and obviously you are going to be speaking a different language. Have a great weekend, sir, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed, and God bless you.
Okay, we'll be transitioning here. We'll be speaking to Mr. Peter Cotton, the Managing Director for National Milling. We'll be discussing National Milling's support and sponsorship of Esther Piri, I believe, the professional boxer, and the company's involvement in the community and other things that they are doing. So let's take a break, and then we'll be speaking to Mr. Cotton in Lusaka.
Enter the country code, city or area code, and local number. To call the United States or Canada, enter the number 1 area code.
You're listening to Zambia Block Talk Radio. I'm handing over to my colleague in Canada, Roger.
Thank you, Nathan, for the great show and a lot of information there from Mr. Elias Chipimo. Now we are transitioning just a little bit here to Lusaka, Zambia. I like to say Lusaka. Lusaka, Zambia. And we have Mr. Peter Cotton. Mr. Peter Cotton is the Managing Director of National Milling. and the sponsor of the boxer, Esther P., who is training here in the United States. Mr. Cotton, welcome to Zambia Block Talk Radio.
Thank you very much. It's good to be on the station.
Thank you so much, sir. I have looked into the information you have been giving us on Esther Pidi, and we have a lot of, you are also the chairman of the Milling Association in Zambia, and we would like to hear something about that. Before I go to Esther Pidi, briefly, tell us about your sponsorship, how it came about. You started to sponsor Esther Pidi.
Yes, look, it's quite a long story. We don't have time to get into, but we've been supporting Esther now for just over 3 years. We actually began the WIBF title in Nairobi, in 2006, late 2006. And then early 2007, she came to see me with her manager trainer, Anthony Wamba, begging that I should sponsor them, under the extra stables, because they had no sponsorship and they had no money to defend the title. And if they didn't defend the title within 3 months, they would have been stripped of the title. And they had heard all the things that I've done in society and sponsorship in sport, and so I suppose I was an obvious target. And I've never supported boxing before. I'm a football fan myself, like most of the listeners, but I listened to the appeal and I thought it was a great opportunity to support a champion, because Esther was an unknown champion, and I thought that she had great ability, and maybe we could use to promote our product. So we took the gamble in March 2000 when she defended the title at Mogadishu Conference Center, and it's a famous victory because she won that, and I think that's where my celebrity fame came about, jumping up and down in the ring as the main support and promoter of the SCP. We've probably seen something like 70 million kwacha in order to save that fight, and we struggled to get many other sponsors, but a few did come on board and supported us because it's the prize of the National Merit. And, she came out to a triumphant and actually kept that belt. She's since gone on to win a total of 5 belts. Two of them are world titles. And, recently, she actually drew in a first challenge for the WIBA belt, which is much higher category than the belt that she's holding. And on May the 29th, she'll actually be having another crack have about again to number one in the world due to Yankovic. So, look, it's been a long road. It's been a very tough one. We've pumped in a lot of money in National Money and all of our supporters, suppliers, and sponsors, but this is the big one. So, yes, we think that all our investment into STP has been worth it because she's our brand icon. She leads our promotion package in order to promote and publicize National Milling and our products. And I think all the listeners know that if you mention STP, you think of National Milling, and that's the whole concept.
All right. Your phone line is not very, very clear. I may drop it and then try to reconnect you if that's okay with you, sir.
No problem at all. Is it any better if I move position for you?
Yes, please. Just wait for us.
Is that any better?
Not really. I think it's our system, so I'll try to use something else so I can connect you to the show.
Okay.
We'll try and reconnect Mr. Peter Cotton. He has a lot of interesting news to give us this morning. So we'll break for a little song, and then we'll try and connect him back. Roberta Manda is from Ndola. She's a very interesting gospel singer. Just listen to this.
Nani sumbula vayao Mweva inga marumbo no ukasha Nami toche la fausi mawemu Neto mlenisa mwewa andi
Hello.
Okay.
Okay, Mr. Kotan, welcome back. Let's try this if this works fine. Hello, Zambia.
Yes, hello. We're hearing you very clearly on the line.
Good, good, good. This is much, much, much better. We appreciated your introduction, which you have given to us. Right now, she is on training here in the United States. What are you working on as far as the fights are concerned?
Yes, since the last fight she had against Terry Blair, who's about number four or five in the world ranking, we realized that there were some weaknesses in her training schedule and even in some of her techniques fighting these very high-caliber female boxers from the States. So we decided to invest with some of our other partners to send her over to Miami to one of the world-famous gyms in Miami, Bonnie Canino's gym, and actually to spar with some of the current female world champions like Yvonne Rees, and also Bonnie Canino herself is an ex-world champion female boxer. So for 6 weeks, she's there in Miami on a very stringent training program and sparring regularly with four or five of these top female boxers. And she actually went 12 rounds with Yvonne Rees 2 days ago and did very well and stood the ground. So we think that we brought Esther up a level in order to be able to counter the number one in the world, Bibi Jankovic, who she'll be facing on 29th of May.
All right. Apart from Esther Piri in sports, are you reaching out to any other sport in Zambia?
Yes, we've always been actively involved in sports. In fact, you know, I personally played for a national million five-a-side team where it's all national million employees and they are registered in the FAS League. I've just come back from a football game myself now. And also, we've been sponsoring a couple of teams in the FAS League as well. And we've done very support for grassroots soccer. That's a USA program for the underprivileged. As far as a soccer program is concerned. And we've done lots of other sports as well. We supported tennis and golf and, well, all sorts of different sports whenever someone's put up a good proposal to us. But certainly in the last 1 year, we're concentrating all of our efforts on Esther Piri because we feel that we brought boxing to another level. It had gone completely dead in this country since the old days of Lottie Wiley. And now you've got a lot of boxing promoters now working, a lot of Zambian boxers. And even in the same stable, Esther Piri's stable, is Kennedy Kanyanta. He'll be on the undercard, the main supporting bill, defending the Africa Boxing Union, the ABU title, on the 29th of May. So we're also supporting him and other local boxers.
Okay, thank you so much. Well, I'll still go back to my question when I said, are you doing... supporting any other sport, apart from where you are in Lusaka, any other places you are going to, say in the provinces, to reach out to those people?
The only thing we've done is to try and develop boxing in other provinces. When we go on nationwide tours with Esther and Anthony Mwamba, it does really lift the whole concept of boxing in the provinces. So we have noticed that certainly in some areas like Northwestern Province and Eastern Province there are, and the Copper Belt, there are now a couple of gyms that are operating and there are a couple of good boxers and local talent coming out of these local gyms. I think finance is the problem, you know, because in the Amateur Boxing Association, there's very little finance coming through the National Sports Council and government. They don't have the resources. So professional boxing has taken off because sponsors like National Lending are supporting professional boxing. So if anything, we've jumped and we've gone to a higher level. But it's very difficult because it's finance that's needed in order to develop the sport more.
Mm-hmm. You also said Esther Piri, I think, is the greatest boxer we've ever had since the times of Lot Mwane. Please tell us, what is the mood as far as boxing and support for Esther Piri is in Zambia?
It's intense, it really is. I've moved around the country with Esther Piri, and I move around the country myself because National Milling are in all 9 provinces, and I tour a lot of our depots and branches. And wherever I go, I get all Esther Piri fans and also customers always asking me about Esther Piri. I was in the Copper Belt yesterday, and every single person that sees me asks about Esther Piri. She is a national icon. And there's no doubt about it that she has the hearts of nearly all Zambians and cuts across all different religions and all different political divides. It doesn't matter where you are, people follow the Esther Piri story. You know, when she's fighting, all the TVs are on in the taverns, they're on the pubs, in the homes, and virtually the country comes to a standstill. So there's no doubt about it, she is a national icon.
Okay. I'll be going to the phone lines for the Zambians who are in diaspora. Speak to us, Mr. Cotton, on the support you may want the Zambians in diaspora in return, in money, in anything to help out this young boxer and even sport in general in Zambia.
Yes, I think the most important thing is the fans should keep supporting her. The press should keep supporting her because I think you know, she's a good ambassador for Zambia. She waves the flag for Zambia. As you know, we haven't been so successful in football or any other sports, and boxing now is right up there with the football. So, you know, it needs a lot of finance. It needs a lot of sponsors and partners to keep coming on board. And most of all, it really needs the fans, you know, because that's what drives her. You know, she is from, you know, the townships, and what people say and what the press say about her affects her, you know. So it's very important that the nation gets behind her.
Thank you. Let me go to St. Paul in Minnesota. Titus Natala has a question for you.
Yes,
no problem.
Good afternoon, Mr. Corona. This is Titus Natala from St. Paul.
Yes, good afternoon. Good afternoon.
My question is, are we going to promote this fight when she is fighting on the 29th of May? Any prospects of it live televised in Zambia and some sorts of internet?
Yeah, thank you very much. Yes. That's a very good question. I have made it possible for all the previous fights to be televised live on ZNBC. And as you know, every single fight so far has been televised live, even the fight she had in Nairobi. Now we have just signed the rights with Supersport International, and it's going to be screened in 42 countries around Africa. Those rights have been signed, and those are the sub-Sahara pay TV rights. That means the local terrestrial rights are still available. We are in negotiations with Movie TV and ZNBC. I have had an offer from ZNBC, which means they do want the rights, but we're still negotiating. But I can assure you, this fight will be beamed live on the local TV networks and on Supersport TV networks. It's very important, not only for Esther, but for our sponsors as well, so they can get maximum publicity out of this fight.
Oh, okay, that's good. Good to hear. Any prospects of the next fight after the May 29th, trying to bring it to the Vegas area or any other part of the world that can generate more money than Zambia?
That is my dream, you know. That is my dream. I keep telling everybody I think we've reached the goal for Esther to fight the number one in the world. But it is in Zambia. Because we feel we owe the Zambian fans that, to fight in Zambia. But certainly my dream would be to see Esther fight in Madison Square Gardens, Las Vegas, you know, places like that. So it all depends on Esther. All depends on the result of this fight. Our contract with Esther actually expires immediately after the fight. So we will be in negotiations immediately after the fight and determine the future. But there's absolutely no discussions about anything after this fight yet, other than I, as the sponsor, would love to continue so one day she can fight in, as you say, Las Vegas or Madison Square Gardens in the States? Because that is the ultimate. That's a very good question, yes.
All right. Let me go to the fan number one of STP, Dr. Kyla Mulenga in Canada. Dr. Mulenga, please come in.
Yeah, hi, good afternoon, Mr. Cotton.
Good afternoon, lovely to speak to you.
I have no question for you except to make a comment, you know, to commend what you are doing. I think we should say it loud and clear that you have the strategy which we need to promote any kind of sport in Zambia. I have been living in North America for over 20 years. I can testify to you and to all the listeners that there is no sport. There is no sport. There is no sportsman or sportswoman in the world who has succeeded without having someone to sponsor them or someone to pump in a little bit of money. So the effort that you are doing, you are demonstrating to Zambians that this is the way to go. There is no other way. In Zambia, they love soccer, but they expect the soccer team, the Chipolopolo Boys, to win just because of natural talent. It will never happen. You have to invest in money, and the way you are doing by in your small way, sponsoring or doing some other things. That's what Zambia needs to do. Infrastructure. Put in money in the infrastructure. Here in Canada, we just had a Winter Olympics here. The Canadians, they have never won the awards or the medals which they did here before because they were hesitant. They didn't think that using money would be a good thing. But this time, every medal was connected. They were calculating how many dollars per medal. They calculated the dollars invested per medal, and they reached their objective. So, Mr. Cotton, I am very proud of you, and I hope that a lot of people are going to see what's happening. We should have a lot of Zambians there who have money, and we should have a lot of companies there who love sports. If they can do what you are doing, Mr. Cotton, please, 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 that's very commendable. I've just been speaking. I'm well connected to Miami, and as I'm speaking now, I checked there. I called before I came to the radio. She's training. She's working very hard. So thank you very much. Please continue what you are doing.
Thank you very much indeed. That is most welcome and it's heartening because it has taken a lot of effort. But I could also thank some of the other Zambian fans that have made an effort to go to Bonnie Canino's gym and actually meet Esther and Anthony at the gym. And that has helped her a lot because she is a long way from home. She is a home girl and she gets homesick. But the fact that she's met some Zambians in Miami has been absolutely fantastic. And in fact, I'd like to throw back a request to you guys over in the States to put some pressure on ESPN. We've written to ESPN. They followed and covered Esther Piri in the past live on ESPN.com. And I would like to see if they could also get the rights because the rights are available worldwide still, and maybe even Eurosport. And, you know, you guys could watch it live in America. But I'm sure through Supersport and the digital TV, it's possible actually to get a connection through internet. But we are talking to ESPN.
Thank you so much. We'll do our best, Mr. Cotton. Let me go to Dallas, Texas. Nathan, please come in.
Thank you, Mr. Cotton. My name is Nathan in Texas. I wanted to, just like Dr. Mulenga said, it's really commendable your involvement and national meeting support for sponsoring Esther Piri and the boxing profession. My question is relating to investment in infrastructure. Obviously, the investment of coming up or building or developing a boxing gym or training facilities, as they may call it, the cost will not be compared to a stadium. Is your company considering investing in some like minimal cost infrastructure of some sort?
It's a very good question. Unfortunately, we don't have the resources. You know, we've all been through the recession in the last year. I mean, it wasn't for that. certainly that was on the program because Hector and Anthony started their own gymnasium company, and they had every intention of building a gym and so on. But some of those plans, unfortunately, have been put on the back burner because of the recession. But we are coming out of the recession in Zambia nicely. And I'm sure that the impetus will get going again if she wins this fight and we get a lot more partners and sponsors to come on board. I mean, getting Zambia on board now after all this time, they've never sponsored Esther in the past, is marvelous. That's a real shot in the arm for us because, you know, they pump a lot of money into this type of social activity. But what I can tell you is there is a new Olympic stadium being built just down the road from the Independence Stadium, where Esther currently trains at Independence Stadium Gym, which is very poor facilities, which is why we sent her to Miami. And so we're hoping under this new Olympic stadium, which has started, there will be gym and boxing apparatus and the type of equipment we need to bring up these world champions. So I think, you know, down the road, maybe a year or so, some of those facilities are slowly coming together, but it's all about success. It's all about promoting boxing to rest of the period, and I think these things will follow naturally.
Okay, thank you so much. We have a caller who's calling us on Skype. Skype, please come in.
Roger, maybe it's Isaac calling from Germany.
Yes, Isaac, good morning or good afternoon in Germany. Please come in with your comment.
Good afternoon, it's afternoon here. Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity. I'm happy to hear Mr. Cotton to what he's doing as a sports in Zambia. I personally have been a sportsman, and I'm encouraged to see such people who are doing such activities. My own concern, I want to go the same line that Dr. Kalenga has talked about, and nothing about the infrastructure. I used to train at the Independence Stadium in Lusaka, and there used to be a gym, but it was already in bad status. I don't know if they are thinking in those lines, you know, to improve the already existing facilities. I also trained at Kavata Shopping Center. There is a small hall where you could find people train, but you know, they were just using their own initiative. My question is the national meeting trying to go to the people as well as to in order to identify talents in indirectly, you know, helping them by supplying them the facilities that they want?
Yeah, it's a good question, but, you know, it's a difficult one because, you know, in the private sector, there's only so much money that we can actually put to corporate social responsibility and sponsorship. You know, at the end of the day, a private company is there driven by profits. You know, how much of that can you plow back in? We plowed an awful lot back in under Esther Thierry just to put on these tournaments and send her abroad. She, as you know, she's been in Germany, she's been in Denmark, all across Europe, and now in the States, you know, getting exposure for her. All that costs an awful lot of money. On the infrastructural side, as I mentioned about the Olympic stadium going up, but yes, the gym at Independence Stadium is very poor quality, but it's breeding champions because, you know, they work hard in the gym. They've got tires, they've got weights, they've got a mock ring, you know, and it's amazing. It's breeding champions. So equipment definitely can help, you know, but sending her away to have sparring against world champion boxers, I think, is also vital. It's not just about fitness, because we worked hard on Esther's fitness levels, but it's taking her to another level. And sparring against high-caliber boxers is very, very important. So you've got to spend money on that as well as infrastructure. If you take one of the other promoters, Oriental Quarries, they've actually got a proper gym and a proper ring for their boxers. So the boxers are under Oriental Quarries. Chingango used to be under them, you know, far better facilities than Esther's training under Independence Gym. Certainly in Ashton Milling, we'd like to get a few partners together and maybe put up a similar place as Oriental Quarries have done, because I don't think it would be too expensive, but we'd have to work that with some partners. So as I keep saying, let's see how we get on at this fight, because this will drive us forward to the next step and the next stage.
Go ahead, go ahead.
Yes, is there anyone in vision after Esther Pili? Are we looking at someone else? Esther Pili is getting old. Have we identified someone else who'd take over from Esther Pili? Is there anything in those lines?
That's a very good question. That's a very good question. I've been asked that many times. The answer is we did have what I thought was the next Esther Pili. It was a girl called Yvonne Kapapa, she fought last time we fought in Zambia against a Kenyan, and I was very impressed, and I wanted her to be the next Esther Pili. Unfortunately, since she's failed medicals, and she's had to retire from boxing. This is one of the sad stories about life as it is in Zambia at the moment. Some of these boxers are failing their medical tests. It's happened two or three times now to good boxers, and they've actually forced them out of the game. You know, you've got to stay healthy in order to box, because there are certain rules, that you have to be negative for A, B, and C, and these things, or you can't box. So, unfortunately, that was a lost opportunity. But Kennedy Kenyatta is our male boxer, our champion in Exeter Stables. He is fighting the ABU defense title, and one day we want to put him up for a world title. So, and Kennedy's still a young man. He's an ex-gold medalist in the Commonwealth Games. And we would quite like to promote the men's side of boxing as well through Kennedy Kenyatta. So definitely we'll keep with Kennedy what happens to Esther from this fight onwards.
Okay. Let me allow a last question here from our dear friend in Wisconsin. Marta, please come in with a comment or a question to Mr. Peter Cotton, who is the sponsor of Esther Pili.
Mr. Cotton, I have a quick question for you. The relationship between you and Esther is to a large extent business. My question is, if you were not supporting her in boxing activities, what other activities would you be pumping your money in to give the boost, necessary boost to your products, as Esther has done? What other alternatives do you have?
Yeah, I think that's a bit of a speculative question because we are supporting Esther Pili and she is our brand icon. And so we can't say, well, what would we have done if she wasn't there? I think that by, me coming up with this concept, and it's something that we all know is well known in the West, to endorse a sportsman and make them a brand icon, an endorsement. And that's exactly what it is, because she's on a retainer. She works for us as the company. And I think it's the first time that any company's ever done that for a sports person in Zambia. Even Klucia Bali, I don't know if he was ever endorsed by any one particular company. So I think that, we do have Esther Pili, and we've never thought about anything else. And we have a very strong relationship in the sense that with Mwamba, Esther Pili, and myself, it's been a fantastic partnership. We've always been able to counsel her and get her to be a world champion. And it's taken a lot of doing. These things don't come by chance. They don't come by luck. It takes an awful lot of counseling, an awful lot of work, commitment, and passion. And I think that's where we've come from, and that's why we're now fighting probably one of the greatest female tour of fights that's coming up on May the 29th between two top boxers in the world.
Mr. Peter Cotton, thank you so much. We'll probably be getting back to you. I have a lot of questions about the farming, how you are paying the farmers there. That is the topic of another day, but we really appreciate you having...
Okay.
Yes, we really appreciate you for having come on our show today. We'll probably be getting back to you soon. Thank you so much, Mr. Peter Cotton.
No problem at all. Thank you very much. And all those viewers out there in America, please watch us and support us on May the 29th. Thanks very much.
We'll definitely support you. Thank you so much, sir. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That was Mr. Peter Cotton. He's the Managing Director of National Meeting in Zambia, the supporter and sponsor of the young boxer Esther Pili. Dr. Mlenga, I heard Esther Pili from you the first time I heard about her. How come this information hasn't been all over the news? To some of us, we only heard about this lady this year, and yet Mr. Kotan is saying this young lady has been on the scene since 2006.
Yes. Well, one of the things is that you don't play the drum, you know. You go slow, you know. You go slow. I think they have been going slow, but because you see, the results will tell itself. You see, at the moment, it's only perhaps maybe we in the diaspora. But in Zambia, I check around when I talk to people. They know a lot about her, and you see, because Zambia is first in winning some things. So every little win that she makes, people are very proud. They're jumping in there, you see. Perfect. So slowly but surely, you know, she's making herself a name.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for having joined us in this part of the segment. In our next segment, we are going to have our brother from the UK who is going to talk to Dr. Lukomona on how to be a millionaire. You don't want to miss that. After that, Dr. Munsanje from Philadelphia will also be joining us. The young lady from Mississippi, she's an advocate of breast cancer. She was very articulate last week, but due to our technical difficulties we had, we decided to bring just about everything we had programmed for last week to this week. So please log in again as we take a short break, and then you can please call in, and then we'll join Patson and Dr. Lukomona, and later on Dr. Munsanje will be joining us. Short song from Roberta Manda from Ndola.
Okay.